second here. Okay. So for those of you who have been here before, we've done a series of classes on early Jewish history, focusing on the patterns. The theme was this idea of the actions of the fathers are assigned to the children, which is a quote from Nachmanides, the great medieval commentator on the Bible from Spain, showing that that which happens in the beginning of early Jewish history is the revealed pattern for everything that comes later. I went through a whole bunch of classes showing how you can learn so many patterns out of early Jewish history. Then what we did was we went through a series of classes on religions of the world. We did paganism, Christianity, Islam. And what we saw, by the way, at the end of the Islam class was that really what's going on in the Middle East today in the Arab-Israeli conflict has basically little or nothing to do with the Palestinian issue and much more to do with Islamic worldview and theology. We're not going to go back into that now, but I want to put it all together in sort of like a summary class, which is called Israel and Yishmael, the metaphysical roots of the Middle East conflict. What I want to do is show you how, on the deepest level, by going into the sources, and it's really a combination of everything we looked at now, and really focusing on this actions of the fathers are assigned to the children concept, that by looking at the early interaction of some characters in the book of Genesis, we can get the real deeper understanding of what really drives the Middle East conflict. And of course, what the solution is also. So as not to get distracted by the smokescreen of front page news headlines, which really has nothing to do with anything. So begin with, let's look at this quote from Maimonides. Maimonides, from over 800 years ago, the great rabbi of his generation, was writing to the Jewish community of Yemen. Interestingly, both my kids have married Yemenites, so now I have I have Yemenite grandchildren. They're very cute. But back then, in the bad old days, the Muslims were putting massive pressure on the Jewish community, and Maimonides was corresponding with them, and he writes in his epistle to the Jews of Yemen, his letter to the Jews of Yemen in 1172, look what he writes. The nation of Ishmael persecutes us severely and devises ways to harm and debase us. Then when he says the nation of Ishmael, who are we talking about? The Arabs, okay, Islam. None has matched in debasing and humiliating us. None has been able to reduce us as they have. We have done as our sages of blessed memory have instructed us, bearing the lies and absurdities of Ishmael. We listen, but we remain silent. In spite of all this, we are not spared from their wickedness and their outbursts at any time. On the contrary, the more we suffer and choose to conciliate them, the more they choose to act belligerently toward us. No matter how much we suffer and elect to remain at peace with them, they stir up strife and sedition. As David predicted, I am all peace, but when I speak, they are for war. Guys, you could put this on the front page of the Jerusalem Post today, and it fits 110%. It's scary how nothing has changed. But he talks about, notice, the nation of Ishmael. And it's the Arabs and Islam as we understand it. And as I said previously, one of the few things that we Jews agree with our Arab Muslim cousins is they agree they're from Ishmael, and we agree they're from Ishmael. And taking this idea that the actions of the fathers are assigned to the children, that which happens in early Jewish history is the revealed pattern from what comes later, if we look at the earliest relationship between Ishmael and Isaac, and we'll see some very interesting stuff. So first of all, just to look at one more quote before we go into the ancient sources. Look at quote number 5. This is Rabbi Chaim Vital. Rabbi Chaim Vital was one of the great rabbis of Sfat in the generation after the Ari HaKadosh, Rabbi Isaac Luria. We're talking about 16th century Sfat. And look what he writes in his book, Eitz Hadat, The Tree of Knowledge. And he was a great Kabbalist. He says, at the end of days, meaning as we approach the end of days, Israel is destined to experience the Ishmaelite exile, the fifth and last exile, which will be most difficult of all. It is the exile of Ishmael. Now, what's the fifth and last? What he's playing off is the famous prophecy of Daniel in the book of Daniel, where Daniel describes this very funky prophecy, this beast with four heads. And these four heads are symbolic of, later the rabbis understand them to be the four great exiles of the Jewish people. Babylon, Persia, Babylonian exile, Persian, you know, story of Purim, Babylon, destruction of the first temple, Greece, the Hanukkah story, Rome. First and second temple period, which led to two big exiles and our dispersion around the world. So,
which one is the fifth?
Well, that he's saying, he's adding, and there is no fifth head to the beast. He's saying that the final exile, which is not necessarily a physical exile, but it's also synonymous with the final great torment of the Jewish people, is going to be what's called this Ishmaelite exile, which is going to be the worst of all of them. So put that on hold. Now let's go back into the early sources. And focusing on this idea of the actions of their fathers are assigned to the children, we're going to jump around a lot here. But we're going to start with Abraham. Remember, we said Abraham is a mini version of what the Jewish people are about. Like, his drive is our drive. His mission in his lifetime is the national historic mission of the Jewish people. And not to go through this in detail because we don't have time, but what sets Abraham apart from everyone else, as I've mentioned multiple times already, is A, in a world that was totally devolved into paganism, Abraham was this free-thinking super genius who thought outside the box and came up with this incredible idea of an infinite invisible God, which is completely, by the way, counterintuitive, an amazing thing. But his real greatness was also, it's one thing to know something that's transformative and revolutionary, but to be not be afraid of what anyone thinks and to say it regardless of the consequences, truth regardless of consequences, is Abraham's great strength. He has this tremendous, tremendous drive for meaning, ultimate meaning. This mission to bring the world back to God. So free-thinking, driven, revolutionary, and also how did Abraham bring people back to God? What was he known for? His tool originally was hasbet chesed. Chesed, it's different. Chesed is a different thing. What is chesed? Chesed is I emulate God. I'm sort of like God. That God gives unconditionally, I give. Okay? That's you know, he used to give people an apple, and people would say, thanks for the apple. And he'd say, you're thanking me? I'm just passing on the apple. Look who made it. It's an amazing thing. Got its own wrapper, totally biodegradable, no carbon footprint, tells you when it's ripe, tells you when it's off, tastes great, healthy. If you look on the back, the page, I summarize some stuff for you here. And we're going to go through our first character, Abraham. So it says, if you look where it says there, character traits, truth seeker, idealistic. He's very individualistic, which explains this very stubborn, stiff-necked personality we have. Dedicated and self-sacrificing, and he's into chesed. Those are like the essential traits. Well, we got to throw another character into the story because Abraham, we know, is married to Sarah, but she's barren till a very late age. And so what does Sarah do to enable Abraham to have some biological offspring? She goes and gives her maidservant, who is Hagar. Who is Hagar? She's not some cleaning lady brought in from Central America. Yeah, she's Pharaoh's daughter, one of the gifts that Abraham got when he went down to Egypt. They get very interesting gifts in the Middle East, like take a camel and a few daughters, you know, whatever. She's a very righteous woman, Hagar. She has no problem. She gets pregnant immediately. And as soon as she gets pregnant, she starts mocking her mistress. Like, if she's so great, how come she's barren? Why is she being punished? And she's thrown out of the house for being chutzpahdik, as they say. Sarah demands she be dumped out of the house. She can't speak to me that way. Now, if you look, keep going in the narrative. She's pregnant, thrown out of the house, like wandering around. And look at quote number 11. This is Genesis 16, verses 9 through 12. And an angel of God said to her, Hagar, I will greatly increase your offspring. An angel appears and says, and they will be too numerous to count. Behold, you shall conceive and give birth to a son. You shall name him Ishmael, for God has heard your prayer. And he shall be a wild ass of a man. His hand will be against everyone, and everyone's hand shall be against him, and over all his brothers shall he dwell. Now, if you're in a previous class, we went through this quote before. We're going to do it again now. It's very interesting. So Ishmael's a very interesting guy in many ways. First of all, he's one of the only people who's not only is his gender given before he's born, but his name is given before he's born. Not too many people in the Bible are named prior to their birth. And in his name, Ishmael, Yishma, do the Hebrew, it's easier. Yishmael, which means what? What does it translate to? Literal translation. God listens. God listens. His name, God hears. Already that gives us a clue that God listens. He has some spiritual, as we say in Hebrew, protexia. You guys know what protexia is? Protexia is not what you know, it's who you know. And the best protexia is with the creator of heaven and earth there, right? So he says, he's given a blessing. He's going to be a huge nation. It's parallel to the blessing we'll see later that Abraham gives regarding Isaac. He says, and God has heard your prayer. He will be, by the way, the expression here in Hebrew, wild ass of a man. In Hebrew, the expression is pere adam. Now in Hebrew, what comes first, the noun or the adjective? Like how do you say in English, the adjective comes first. It modifies the noun, big boy. The big is the adjective, boy is the noun. In Hebrew, how do you say big boy? Yeled gadol. Meaning the first word is the noun, and the second word is the adjective. So pere adam, the essence of Ishmael, as we're being told, is pere or adam. It's the wild ass side. He's equated with this animal, which is Judean wild ass, which is, by the way, an animal. But they have, I have to say, this is not politically correct, but reality is not politically correct. Okay, God is not PC. PC is like don't want to offend anyone, but then miss the point. So it might sound politically incorrect, but you'll see it's remarkably accurate. Now, by the way, the animal he's referring to... Wild ass. Now, it's a wild ass, not an animal we're familiar with in America, for instance. It's a Judean wild ass. There's certain, every animal species has like a cousin that is not domesticatable. Horses, zebras, dogs, wolves, you know, cows, Cape buffalo, you know, donkeys, and Judean wild ass. It's an animal with a real attitude. He's going to be a wild guy. Okay? And then the next expression is one of the most interesting of all. It says, his hand will be against everyone, and everyone will be against him. It's over in the thing. It's actually the actual, his hand, it's actually Yad Kolbo. In Hebrew, the expression is very enigmatic. So as soon as you get enigmatic expressions in the Bible, the rabbis jump in, the commentators, and based on their much deeper knowledge, try and give you a deeper understanding. Rashi, our great medieval commentator, who lived in Troyes, outside Paris, 1,000 years ago, who is one of the, he's really the most basic of all Bible commentators. Look what Rashi says in quote 13. One who loves deserts to hunt animals, he's commenting on this description in the Bible, he will be a bandit. All will hate and attack him, and his offspring shall be great. He's going to be, the essential quote here is going to be like a nomadic guy, which is, by the way, the Arab ideal, the Bedouin. You know the Bedouin Arabs you have in Israel? Over quite a few of them. They don't live in, they don't like to live, settle down. They like to do what the Arabs used to do, which is to wander around and live in tents. Okay, that's the ideal. But he's going to be... Bedouin are a subcategory of Arabs. Okay, remember, Arabs and Islam are often used interchangeably, but as I said in a previous class, today 70% of Muslims aren't Arabs. But Islam incorporates the basic worldview of the people that it came from, which is the Arabic people.
70% of what?
Of Muslims are not Arabs today. But guys, the interesting part of the quote he says is that he's going to fight with everyone. Now again, not politically correct, but pretty accurate. Take Muslims slash Arabs out of conflicts in the world today, what percentage of world conflicts disappear? I'm not exaggerating, it's at least 90%. Pretty much every war or conflict going on in the world today is Arabs or Muslims, the whole Middle East, Africa, Asia, it's, except for like some Basques. Now you got, we have, the only thing distracting us is the, what's going on in Ukraine. But it's unbelievable how much confrontation there is. A more interesting comment, by the way, comes from Uncleus. Uncleus is the Aramaic translator of the Bible. Uncleus is the grandnephew of the Roman Emperor Titus, who's the guy who destroyed Jerusalem. He converts to Judaism, and he does the Aramaic, which was the international language of the ancient world. Aramaic translation, like art scroll of his day, was Uncleus. And his translation is considered to be on such a high spiritual level, it contains aspects of the prophetic in it. What does Uncleus say on here? And I didn't put it in here, the translation, but I'll tell you what he says. Uncleus says about his hand will be in everyone, that he will need everyone, and everyone will need him. And he's saying this 2,000 years ago, exactly, oil. Again, not PC, but very accurate. Take oil out of the economic equation of the Middle East, guys. You want to hear a great statistic? 6 million Jews in Israel on 10,500 square miles of territory have a greater gross domestic product than the 22 states of the Arab League with 5.5 million square miles of territory and 300 million people in it. Without the oil. The Arab world literally produces nothing besides that. It's a one commodity economy, which is a curse for them and a curse for us. But it's amazing how Uncle is 2,000 years ago, before anyone knew about oil. Sorry? I'm saying Israel's gross domestic product without oil exceeds all 22 states of the Arab League. 6 million Jews. No, Israel's gross domestic product without oil in the equation. Take oil out of the Middle East, meaning what else did the Arab world produce? Israel's GDP is greater than the entire Arab world's 22 states of the Arab League with 300 million people in it. It's an amazingly sad statement, but whatever. Okay, I don't want to spend a talk about the modern politics, but it's amazing how prescient and prophetic this is. Now, go back to quote 12. This is Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer, which is a collection of Midrashim. Midrash is rabbinic literature put together by the rabbis thousands of years ago, usually, or between, you know, whatever, a millennia and a half ago to 2,000 years ago. Some of it is literal, some of it is allegorical. But Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer says, out of the 70 languages that the Holy One, blessed be He, created in this world, He put His name, meaning El, only on Israel. Since the Holy One, blessed be He, equates the name of Yishmael with the name of Israel, alas, who can survive in Ishmael's day? It says God calls His people the Jewish people, Israel. But there's another nation that He gives His name to, which is Yishmael, which means that Yishmael has the protexia. We got to be careful because God listens to him, and he's essentially a spiritual being. Now, by the way, fast forward in our story. Let's keep moving here because we got to cover a lot of history here. Sarah, at age 91, now, like I said, there never should have been a Jewish people. We should have died off in one generation. The continuation, the perpetuation of the Jewish people is in every generation supernatural. Trust me, us sitting in this room today, opposite the Western Wall, have no idea how supernatural that is. We violate all the laws of human history, but starting with Sarah at 91 years old, she gives birth to Isaac, who is the half-brother of Ishmael. But because Isaac is the product of Abraham and Sarah, and by the way, the woman makes you Jewish, not because you always know who the mother is, but because the internalness of who you are comes from the mother. She cooks you in the oven for 9 months. Like my wife says, it's not fair. The women do all the work and the kids look like the father anyway. But in this case, so it takes the female internalness to make the Jewish people. That's why all the men marry women from the same family over here. So Isaac is born when Sarah is very old. Abraham's like 100. Sarah's like 91 years old. Isaac is married to whom? Rebecca. Okay. But let's go back into our narrative here. Now, before Isaac is born, God tells Abraham, you're going to have a child through Sarah, which is quite supernatural. Abraham is a little bit, not that he, Abraham obviously knows God can do whatever he likes, but this is like, what's Abraham's reaction? Quote 15, which is Genesis 17, verses 18 through 21. And Abraham said to God, oh, that Ishmael might live before you, meaning it's enough. I have enough. I have a son. Thank you. God said, nonetheless, your wife Sarah will bear you a son, and you shall call his name Isaac. Notice again, his gender and his name are given before he's born, just like with Ishmael. And I will fulfill my covenant with him as an everlasting covenant for his offspring after him. Again, in every generation, God reaffirms that the bloodline of chosenness of the Jewish people and Abraham's mission in the world goes through Isaac, then Jacob, and so forth. But look, go back now. What does God finish off with? But as for Ishmael, I have heard you. Meaning, not only does his name contain God hears, but Abraham, you bless him. Now, this is a point I brought up previously. When people who are spiritually connected, who are prophets like Abraham and Isaac, words that come out of their mouth have tremendous power potentiality to change things. They actually set gears moving up in the metaphysical world that impact the physical world. So he says, for Isaac, I have heard you. You bless him? You say, would that he should live before you? I blessed him. I will make him fruitful and increase him most exceedingly. He will have 12 princes, and I will make him into a great nation. 12 princes, what is that parallel? What's the parallel? 12 tribes of Israel, right? But I will maintain my covenant through Isaac. So we see here, because of who Ishmael is and because of what's in his name and God gives him a blessing, what Abraham says about him, he is essentially a spiritual guy. Okay, and by the way, you're going to see he has a beef with Isaac. What's Ishmael's beef with Isaac, obviously? Why is he upset with Isaac? Because he will ultimately be, even though he is the firstborn, bypassed. He should have been the inheritor of the spiritual mission of Abraham. Look at what Rav Chaim Vital in Eitz Hadass says. Again, this is going back to the 16th century. Quote 16. Were it not for God who was with us, we would have perished in the Ishmaelite exile. For as a result of being called a man, as a son of our father Abraham, he has the merit of his ancestors. He has zchut avot, which is what we have. Abraham's his father. As we find Abraham saying to him, oh, that Ishmael might live before you, to which the Holy One, blessed he, answers, but as for Ishmael, I have heard you. He, meaning Ishmael, also has the merit of circumcision. Interesting. This is an additional reason why he's called a man. This is why his exile is more severe than those imposed on the other four, Babylon, Persia, Greece, and Rome. The other four kingdoms, as mentioned in Daniel. So he has merits. He's a child of Abraham. He gets a blessing from Abraham. He's circumcised. We'll see at 13 years old. And let me just jump forward here. It's quite interesting. Let me find the quote here. Yeah, go to quote 24. This is the Zohar. You guys know the Zohar? The Zohar is the basic book of Jewish mysticism. In Jewish tradition, it was written by Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, when hiding in a cave from the Romans in the early 2nd century of the Common Era. And again, it gives us very deep understanding of what's going on in the text of the Torah. So look at this Zohar in Parshat Vayera, which is in the book of Genesis. Very fascinating. Through his circumcision, Ishmael entered into the holy covenant before Isaac was born. Right? Said he, Ishmael's guardian angel. The idea is every nation in the world has a guardian angel, like a representative, like in the UN, who represents them. Okay, we have God directly, but everyone else gets a guardian angel. And his guardian angel says, yet as Ishmael has been circumcised, he ought to have reward. Woe, woe that Ishmael was born into this world and was circumcised. What did the Holy One do? I mean, he has to get payoff. He banished the children of Ishmael from the heavenly communion, meaning he doesn't make them the chosen people, and gave them instead a portion here below in the Holy Land, in the land of Israel, because of his circumcision. And they are destined to rule over the land a long time, so long as it is empty. And they will prevent Israel from returning to their own land until the merit of the children of Ishmael have been exhausted. When we go into exile, Ishmael, on the merit of his circumcision, now when did the Muslims conquer the land of Israel? We mentioned 638 CE. When did they lose the land of Israel? 1917 CE. Okay, what's the, give or take a little, a couple years. What do we got here? 1,300 years, Muslims of various dynasties will control the land of Israel. The understanding on a metaphysical level, this is his payoff. He doesn't get to be the Jewish people. He doesn't get to be the chosen guy and have the mission, but he has to get his reward. Interesting, very interesting. Okay, so that's character number one. Now, Isaac and Rebekah, she also is married a long time before she has kids. Every generation, it's very difficult to make the Jewish people. She finally gets pregnant in this tumultuous pregnancy where and she has nothing to base it on in terms of what a normal pregnancy should feel like. Now back today, you go for an ultrasound. Back then, she went for a spiritual ultrasound. Remember what happens in the story? She goes to the study hall of Shem and Ever, descendants of Noah, the only other people in the world who have any monotheistic tradition, to get a spiritual read on what's happening. And if we find out and that appears in, here we go. Quote 17, Genesis 25, verses 23 to 27. So she gets a prophecy, and God says to her, to Rebekah, excuse me, two nations are in your womb. Two peoples from your inside shall be separate. The might shall pass from one regime to the other. And the elder shall serve the younger. Now she's told, it's twins. Wow. But they're very different. There's this tumult going on inside her stomach. And this is a war going on in there. When her term to bear grew full, when it came time to give birth, then behold, there were twins in her womb. The first one emerged red and tired like a hairy mantle. So they named him Esau. So he's the first guy out of the womb. We've got to give him the right color. I've got to make him red. Here's Esau. After that, his brother emerged from his hand grasping onto his heel. So he is Jacob, Yaakov, from the word heel, exactly from. The lads grew up, and Esau became a hunter and a man of the field, but Jacob was a pure man abiding in tents. I say I have twin girls, identical twin girls. They're very different personality, but they look the same physically. They used to give each other dresses and say, put this on, I want to see what I look like, that kind of stuff. But in this case, these guys are totally different. Even my twins might look a lot alike, but they're very different personality. But at least they're very good friends. These guys are not very intense, competitive relationship, to say the least. And Esau is described as someone who is, you can see what he says. He's a man of the field, right? He's a doer, as a hunter. He's called, by the way, Tzayed Bepiv. Tzayed is a hunter. Bepiv is with his mouth. Doesn't mean he's a vampire. He's considered to be an incredibly deceptive, smooth, fast-talking guy. But description of him, and again, we should go back to our back page here a second, the summary. We skipped over Ishmael. And we talked about that he has his character traits, his monotheism, okay, his dedication, hospitality. We're going to see this is the stuff, confrontational, the oil thing, the character traits. But he's a child of Abraham, he gets a blessing, okay, circumcised. So he has his traits. But now we go into the Esau traits, at the number below. So he's a hunter, he's a man of action, he's portrayed as being very violent. He's also portrayed as being very fast talking. He's a very deceptive person, which means he's the great grandfather, therefore, of all lawyers and on a spiritual level, and therefore all politicians. Because, lawyers are just larval forms of politicians. Think about it, all these politicians. What do they start out as careers? They were all lawyers beforehand. But he's also the last guy you want to play poker with. Because, poker face, he is very deceptive. He's a cheat. He's not honest. He has his father fooled. Although he has one specific merit, that he was considered the grand master of doing which commandment? The Torah describes him as being the greatest fulfiller of which commandment? Honoring your father. There's a commandment in the Torah, kibud av v'eim. It's called honoring your father and your mother. He wasn't into honoring his mother, but he was very into honoring his father to the point where he's flattering him and honoring him. And even has his father, who's a pretty sharp guy, somewhat deceived. But he's the physical guy. He's the guy who's always got picked first to play any sports game. He's a total doer. He's a man of action. He's the logical, on a superficial level, the logical guy to carry on the mission. He's a leader. Jacob is considered the Ishtam Yoshev Ohalim. He's the, as the Bible describes him, he's the simple guy who sits in the tent. He's got the pasty white skin, the glasses. He reads the scrolls all day, not enough physical exercise. His mother's always telling him, go outside and play. He's the best guy to play poker with, like straight as an arrow, like can't lie, can't bluff. And he's like the last guy to get picked on the sports team because he's not like physical. He's kind of geeky. But like Rebecca, it says that Isaac loved Esav and Rebecca loved Jacob. So part of Isaac's loving Esav is that Esav's deceiving his father a little, and also that Esav was really good at honoring him. And his father sees he's a great on a doing level. Jacob will send to get the postdoctorate. But we see that there's more going on. And we fast forward in the story. And later in the narrative, as far as we are here. Yeah, later in the narrative, when Esav comes in from a day of violence and hunting and murder, and he's really hypoglycemically hungry, he asks his brother, who's making some cholent for some food, you know, some Heinz baked beans. He says, feed me. I'm like really hypoglycemic here. And his brother says, fine, give me your birthright. Let me be the firstborn, which is the responsibility part of this agreement. Birthright is the responsible side. And he says, Halateni na min adom adom azeh, pour that red stuff down my throat, and you can have it. He despises his birthright. He gives it away for nothing, basically. We fast forward later in the story when Isaac is old and blind. His brain is perfectly fine and his hearing is great, but he doesn't see anymore. And we have this really great pivotal moment in history when everything is in the balance here and can change, when Isaac wants to bless Esau. Now, first of all, we have to appreciate what's going on in the story. Like imagine today your father says, come here, son, I want to give you a blessing. You'll say like, thanks, Dad. Can I have the car keys? Like, who cares? Save it for Friday night. But back then, you have to appreciate, A, when a person who's spiritually connected like Isaac focuses his words on you, it has tremendous power potentiality. This is powerful stuff. This is like a big deposit in your bank account. But not only that, what's he really doing in the story? He's anointing Esav to do what? I'm old, I'm retiring, you take over the family business, which is what? It's not the shmata business, as we say in Rag business, New York. You take over the business of making the chosen people. This is where Rebecca steps in and saves the day. We see the women are always seeing things the men don't see because they have women's intuition. They always say behind every great man is a totally exhausted wife and a completely surprised mother-in-law. In this case, the women are always making the right moves and telling them, you know, you got to listen to your wife. What can you say, you know? Hey, that's that joke. How do you know Abraham was Sephardic and not Ashkenazic? God had to tell him to listen to his wife. All Ashkenazi men listen to, run into that funny joke that the kid comes home. He goes, Mom, I got a role in the school play. And she says, what role did you get? She goes, I got the Jewish husband part. She goes, I told you to get a speaking part. But in this case, Rebecca jumps in and saves the day. Because she goes, as Esav's out hunting to prepare good food for his father so he'll be in a good state of mind, enter a state of prophecy and give him a great blessing, he comes in dressed as his brother with goat skin on. Always reminds me, like, how hairy was Esav? I think of, like, Planet of the Apes when I read this. You ever seen a goat? I mean, this is hairy. He comes in, he brings in this food to his father. He says, come, father, and eat so you can bless me. And his father says, I think I even put it in here. Here it is, Genesis 27, verses 21 to 22. And Isaac said to Jacob, come close, if you please, so I can feel you, my son. Are you indeed my son Esav or not? So Jacob drew close to Isaac, his father, who felt him and said, Hakol kol Yaakov, the voice is the voice of Jacob, Hayadayim yadei Esav. Now again, simple reading of the story is you sound like one, you feel like the other. He's confused. He feels he got the goat skin on. But this is a pattern for deeper things going on. Without to go back into a huge explanation, the voice is associated with Jacob. Remember, speech is a uniquely human thing. Animals can communicate, they do not speak. The ability to transmit information abstractly, like philosophically, is a uniquely human thing. That is the ultimate expression of human intellect is speech, like what I'm doing now. Like my brain is sending impulses to my tongue, my cheeks, my mouth, my lungs. It's all moving in coordination, sending sound waves across the room that are hitting your eardrum. You know, it's an unbelievable thing that you're hopefully understanding what I'm talking about. This is associated with Jacob. Jacob becomes whom? He gets his name changed later to Israel. He is literally the physical embodiment of the Jewish people. We're being told, HaKol Kol Yaakov, the power of the Jewish people has never been physical.
know that joke, what's the sign of maturity in the Jewish boy when he recognizes statistically has a far greater chance of owning a professional sports team than actually playing on one? Our power is intellect. We've always had to do it with using our brains in a very disadvantageous situation. So that's the essence of the Jacob, the Jewish people. The hand is the hand of Esav. Now, Esav, who does, let's go back. Esav in Jewish tradition becomes whom? The nation of Edom, the Edomites, the Idumeans. Edom in Jewish tradition becomes?
Rome.
Rome will eventually become, okay, we have Western civilization is overwhelmingly Rome, and Christianity, the Roman Catholic Church. Now we see with, we sort of skipped this a little bit with Ishmael, but with Ishmael, he will become, as we said, the Arabs. And even though today most Muslims are not Arabs, Islam starts as a religion of nomadic Arabic-speaking people of the Arabian Peninsula 1,300 years ago. What's amazing is, think about it, in two generations of one family, you will have the three monotheistic offshoots. The original religion, the two monotheistic offshoots coming out of the one family. So we see, we saw in the previous classes that, Christianity emerges as a splinter sect of Judaism much later in history. It broke away and became a separate religion, and Islam doesn't have quite that close a connection, but nonetheless, Muhammad interacted with Jews and got many of his ideas from them. Here you actually see the connection is much more deeper, biological and spiritual, that it literally begins much earlier on in the history, going back to Genesis, going back 1,600 years ago. Yeah.
I'm a little confused with that.
I'm a lot confused, yeah.
The Palestinians.
Yeah.
Come from?
No, Palestinians is a whole separate modern thing.
They're
the Arabs. Just think of them as Arabs in general. That's just, we're not going to go into the modern etymology of the word, but they're just another part of the Arab world.
Are they the same?
They are. Actually, yes and no. By the way, the broadest definition of Arabs is people who speak Arabic. It's not really a racial definition, because you can see Arab, there. You look at North Africa, you have many different size, shapes, and colors, just like we're not a race. We're a people. There are more of it's a linguistic kind of cultural connection, a religious connection. So you got these three different things going on here. Now Esav is associated with the hand. The hand is also, human hand is unique to us. To have a thumb facing your fingers, and unlike a monkey, which has a much better tail than we have, but a very long, dexterous thumb that can face your fingers, gives human beings unique dexterity to use tools and use hands in a way that no other animal can. So it's uniquely human, but when you think of the hand, what do you think of? Jacob is spiritual, but the hand is physical. It holds the sword, might. The essence of Esav, we see, is good. He's going to be this fighting, physical kind of guy. Now, by the way, he comes back after, not to go into the whole story, Jacob has stolen the blessing, and he's really upset. Because Esav, unlike Ishmael, is not so spiritual. He gives up the responsibility of being the chosen people for the Heinz baked beans. But when it comes to getting the blessing, because within the blessing is a tremendous blessing of physical prosperity, stuff. Esav, we should do a t-shirt. Esav loves his stuff. He's really upset at losing his stuff. So he asks his father, I think I got it in here. Here it is. Quote 18a. He says, and Esav says to his father, he comes back, he's really upset. I lost a blessing? Have you bought one blessing, father? Bless me too, father. This is Genesis 27, chapter 30, verse 38 through 40. So Isaac, his father, answered him and said, behold, of the fatness of the earth shall be your dwelling, and of the dew of the heavens from above. By your sword shall you live, but your brother you shall serve. Yet it shall be that when you are aggrieved, you shall cast off his yoke from upon your neck. Meaning, he really, even though he came out second, he's proven himself to be worthy. Really, he's going to be the firstborn. But if he doesn't do what he's supposed to do, you can give him hell. But he said, by your sword you shall live. Now you think of it. When you think of the sword you shall live, that's probably the single best description of the Roman Empire ever. No people ever glorified war and used war for political ends more than the Roman Empire, in my opinion. Unbelievable. I mean, Romans would literally start wars to further their political careers. That's how you became like Caesar, you know? But we see essentially physical. So their traits are right in there. If you go to the back page, here you can see Esav. His description, character traits. He's a hunter. He's a man of action. He's violent. But he has merits also. He's a child of Isaac. He gets a blessing. He honors his father. And he never leaves the land of Israel. Now remember, what happens to Jacob, because Esau wants to kill him now. He says, as soon as my father's dead, I'm going to kill my brother. He has to flee back to where? He goes to live with Rebecca's brother, whose name is Laban, Mr. White, the biggest crook. Never trust anyone named Mr. White. He's like the biggest crook in the Bible. And there he falls in love with Rachel and ends up being tricked into marrying Leah. And then he marries their two maidservants, Bilhah and Zilpah. I'm not going to go through the whole narrative. This whole competition breaks out. And it's amazing. Jacob, who is this pure, simple guy, has to deal, not simple, stupid, just simple, straight, has to deal with the two most deceptive people in the entire Hebrew Bible, Esau and Laban. And he beats them both at their own game. Like Mark Twain said in his famous quote about the Jews in his essay, he said, the Jew has made a marvelous fight in this world and has done it in every generation with his hands tied behind him. So he manages to accrue his wealth and build his family, but then he knows, God tells him, you got to go back to the land of Israel, which is the only place we can accomplish our destiny. So he packs up his belongings and goes back to Israel, where he knows he's going to meet up with his brother. How long were they separate for? 22 years. You ever heard the expression, time dulls all pain? Except for Esau. He's coming out to meet him with 400 cavalry, which is a lot of men. And what does Esau do? The famous three-pronged strategy we're supposed to learn from. You know, like he prepares to fight. He sends gifts, diplomatic initiative, defensive initiative, and he prays, recognizing that God runs the world. Not going to go through that story in detail, but when they meet, okay, what happens? It's a very interesting interaction. It's very clear, by the way, from this story, that Esau, from the commentators especially, that Esau still hates Jacob, but he doesn't kill him. He's overwhelmed by the emotions of the moment, whatever. And what does he say to him? Quote 19a, Genesis 33, verses 12 through 14. And he, Esau, said to Jacob, travel on and let us go, and we'll travel alongside you. But he, Jacob, said to Esau, let my lord go ahead of his servant, and I will make my way to my slow place until I come to my lord in Seir, where he lives, in Mount Seir. Keeps calling him my lord. He's very obsequious and fawning with him. So, by the way, we know Rashi, who are a great medieval commentator, is always answering the most obvious questions you should be asking. If you're thinking when reading the text, it's a good sign when you look down and there's Rashi answering the question you were just thinking about. So Rashi asks, he assumes we know the text. We know, we've read the text, and we know that Jacob has no intention of catching up to Esau. He's just trying to get rid of him. He doesn't want to live with him. He realizes it's too dangerous for him and his family. If you go on, I'll catch up later. But if he says it, it's got to happen at some point. So Rashi asks, quote 20, which is his commentary on Genesis 33, verse 14, and when will he, Jacob, go to Seir? In the days of the Messiah, as it says. And the expression in Hebrew is Valu Moshim Lahartzion Lishbotet Har Esav. And our Savior will rise from Mount Zion to judge the mountain of Esau. When does a Savior, that's Mount Zion, by the way, out there, not the parking lot, the Jewish quarter, that's the Mount Zion. When does the Redeemer go from Mount Zion to judge the mountain of Esau? Who's the Redeemer we're talking about? The Messiah. Until the Messiah, when Jacob says, the Talmud and Tractate of Odazorah says that they were supposed to walk together as equals, twins. When Jacob says to Esau, you go on ahead, I'll catch up later, he's telling him, you, Esau, Rome, Western civilization, you go on ahead in history. You get your empires, Rome, you get your stuff. You accumulate your territory and your wealth and your flat screen plasma televisions and all the things you want. But in the end, ultimately, he's saying, I don't want the physical reward. That's not the Jewish thing. Nothing wrong with having a comfortable life, but it's not what we're into. Ultimately, at the end of days, the Messianic era, you're getting your payoff in this world because that's really what you want anyway. He just wants his stuff. He's going to sell his birthright for baked beans. He doesn't want the responsibility of fixing the world and bringing the world back to God. So Jacob's telling him, though, the message is, in the end, even you, my brother Esau, and the end of days will eventually line up behind me and recognize that even though you came out first, I and the Jewish people are the firstborn, and you're supposed to follow our lead. So it's really, really cool what's going on here. We see that we have three major players here that create three huge forces in the world. I mean, ours is actually, on an ideological level, the most impactful, but on a physical level, we're the smallest. Like, we don't have empires. The only Jewish empire in history has been Hollywood, and it hasn't been a source of Jewish values. But we have Arabs and Islam, and we have Western civilization and Christianity. It's a triangle, okay? It's a rivalry. We have Jacob, we have Esau, we have Ishmael. Now, interestingly enough, when we think of threats against us today in the Jewish world, if you ask Israelis who's the bigger threat, they'll all say our cousins down the street, the Arabs. But based on this, who's the closer relationship, Isaac to Ishmael or Jacob to Esau? Jacob to Esau has much closer relationship. Esau has the same mother. He could have been the Jewish people. His potential and therefore his rivalry with us and his threats to us are actually greater. And I have to say in history, well, Muslims like to whitewash their treatment of Jews, which has been pretty bad. Nothing compares historically to the horrendously violent treatment the Christian world has focused on the Jewish people throughout history. But that's all water under the bridge, because we have this concept. If you look, we got to finish up here. Look at quote 21. There's a rivalry going on here. It's a three-way rivalry, but the reality is we have never been the great physical. We're in no position throughout history to impose our will on anyone. We're living in exile scattered around the world, but Europe has been locked for, and in the Arab world, for like 1,300 years in the struggle between Islam and Christianity. Look at quote 21, again, the Zohar written almost 2,000 years ago. In Parshat Vayera again, the Torah portion of Vayera. The sons of Ishmael will fight many battles in the world, and the sons of Edom will gather against them and make war against them, some on land, others on sea, some close to Jerusalem, and one shall prevail over the other, but the Holy Land will not be delivered to the sons of Edom. He doesn't get to get the land. Ishmael gets it out of his circumcision thing, seemingly. So we see that on one hand, we're being told that these guys, the Ishmael and Esau guys, are duking it out, and we're sort of on the sidelines. But again, we have this very famous prophecy in Ezekiel and Zechariah that's called the War of Gog and Magog. You guys familiar with it? It's even a quote here. Look at Ezekiel, quote 26. This is one of the many quotes about this. Surely on that day you will come from your place at the utmost parts of the north, you and many people with you, all of them a vast horde, a mighty army. You advance against my people Israel like a cloud covering the earth. It shall be at the end of days that I will bring you upon my land in order that the nations may know me. So we have this idea that they will, on one hand, these guys are fighting amongst each other's major spiritual and physical forces in the world. But on the other hand, they will unite only for one cause alone, which is what? Unless you think this is too abstract, today go to university campus in Europe or America. The only cause that you can get like a radical leftist, lesbian, feminist in the same room with a jihadi, uber right-wing Muslim, like fanatic, agreeing on and is holding up signs on the same side of the protest is to do what? To bash Israel. Because as much as these guys compete with each other, they recognize that the real issue is us. And when you enter the end of days, it's like the final heat of the 100-yard dash in the Olympics. Remember in the Olympics, before you get to the final race, and the guy who finishes is the fastest guy in the world, there's not one 100-yard dash, there's elimination heats. All of history is the elimination heats. And in the end, who are we finally left with? The major players duking it out, as we say, over who is really back to the original story of who's going to be in charge. Who has a right to really be on top? And even though the Jewish thing is not to be physically on top, it's to be recognized as the people who have this unique relationship with God and this unique mission in the world. So if you look back in the sources, again, here we have, exactly. We have this idea that they will fight each other but come together to attack us. Go to now, where do I want to look at? Here, quote number 28. Here's Maimonides again in 1172 in his letter, Epistle to the Jews of Yemen. He's continuing. He started out talking about, we started the class with a comment from him. But regarding that time, meaning Maimonides is now letting us into what we're going to see at the end of days. Sure, these guys are going to be fighting each other throughout history, but when you get to the end of days, it has already been made clear from the words of Daniel, Isaiah, and the rabbis of blessed memory that the coming of the Messiah will take place when the hand of Edom, which is Rome, and the Arab world will be mighty and their rule shall spread throughout the world. There is no doubt about this matter, for it says, and he's quoting now from Isaiah, he will see a chariot, a pair of horsemen, a chariot with a donkey. The chariot with the donkey is the Messiah. The pair of horsemen represents the men of war. That is to say, the alliance of two nations, Edom and Ishmael. So he's saying as much as these two guys hate each other, when they put their differences aside, and it doesn't mean they can't continue to fight with each other. It's exactly what you see. You have an international jihadi thing going on in the world, yet the world still comes together in the form of the General Assembly, in my opinion, the most destructive organization on the planet Earth, on one issue to bash Israel, which is the only organization that has permanent automatic anti-resolutions put into the... You know that? There's a day every year in the General Assembly where six anti-Israel resolutions are automatically tabled, even if no one tables them, they're automatic in the schedule, and Israel's condemned. And if you look at Rabbi Moshe Cordovero in quote 29, the Ramak, again, going all the way back to the 16th century, He says, all the nations will ready themselves, and he's talking about against Jerusalem, and make peace amongst themselves. They will turn against Israel to annihilate it for having established its own government. It's unbelievable. Come on, what's the only thing separating Israel from complete political isolation in the world today? There's only one thing, really. Well, as long as Stephen Harper's prime minister, it's good, but in Canada. But it's actually the United States veto in the Security Council. And with Micronesia and the Marshall Islands supporting it. Because whatever the U.S. votes, they vote. You know, Micronesia is so small, its largest export is its postal stamp. Seriously, if the U.S., forget going anti-Israel, the U.S. was to stand aside and just not vote. You know, like, we're just going to let them, you guys vote, we're just going to abstain. Israel would find itself completely isolated. It's exactly what he says. They will turn against Israel to annihilate it from having established its own government. It will be a time of distress for Jacob, yet they will not collapse but be saved from their distress. It's going to be scary, but don't panic. God's on our side. We survive. But that doesn't mean we should be, like, you know, complacent about this. We're under great threats. And it's exactly, if you put the sources together, you see this exactly what's going on in the world. You have this global jihadi struggle against Western civilization, but they still manage to come together and smash us. They're freaking out about ISIS, but they don't realize it, as Netanyahu was saying, ISIS and Hamas, basically the same thing. The only difference is Hamas doesn't behead people on television. They just shoot them when the camera isn't looking. But it's the reality. It's amazing. They don't see the connection, but that's modern politics. But going back, since the class is, we talked about Esav, but the class is about Ishmael, we have to appreciate that unlike Esav, who really is just a physical being and never really wanted the responsibility and doesn't want the mission, Ishmael, even though he's less related to us than Esav, is much more of a spiritual being. We saw that in his name and his relationship. Yeah?
You just mentioned before about Ishmael that God listens to the prayers more than the Jews?
No, he listens to their prayers. Okay. Not more than us, but he listens to their prayers. It meaning they...
I mean, it's a bit more deeper than the Jews? Or
No. It's not that he listens deeper, but it means when they pray, God listens to them also. Which means we just can't... We have to take them seriously. And guys, this is what it's really about. I just want to show you one really cool quote in here, which is left out of the old version of the quotes. But there's a very famous story in the Torah and the Midrash about how old is Isaac when he's circumcised? He's 8 days old. Whereas Ishmael is 13. By the way, Muslims are supposed to circumcise their kids at 13 years old. They never do it. They take 13 1-year-olds. They do all kinds of interesting permutations, but they never do that. Only Maasai in Africa circumcise their kids at that age. But the story is very interesting because it talks about there's this huge rivalry going on of who is more spiritually connected to God, these two brothers. And one's a lot older than the other. So I'm going to read you from Rashi in Genesis 22:1. He's quoting from a Midrash, rabbinic literature. He says, he, meaning Ishmael, would pride himself over Isaac because he was circumcised at the age of 13. Meaning, you didn't have any choice. You didn't feel anything. I did it at 13, as we say in Hebrew. Who's a bigger gever? Who's a tougher guy? And did not object. I'm better than you. I'm more deserving of you. I gave away. I suffered more because of my connection to God. Isaac said to him, Ishmael, do you try and scare me because of one organ, like a little cut over there? If the Holy One, blessed be He, would say to me, sacrifice yourself before me, I would not refrain from doing it. Forget slitting your, you know what. If he wants to slit my throat, I'll go for that. And what's the next Torah portion? Akedat Yitzchak, the binding of Isaac story. God says, you open your mouth, let's see if it's true. It's amazing, but what's the message here? What are they fighting over? Who is more spiritually connected? Ishmael and his descendants have never gotten over this. Esau's not interested. If you're obsequious and give him his stuff, he's happy. He hates us. There's a rivalry there on a certain level. He's also aware. But on a more spiritual, mundane level, we'd say, Ishmael is much more conscious in his descendants of the spiritual rivalry, which is why you see even today is an amazing, I always say he's the mirror image. We have Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. They have Shihada, which is La ilaha illa Allah, Muhammad Rasul Allah. There is no God but God. Muhammad is His messenger. We pray 3 times. They pray 5 times. We fast 1 day on Yom Kippur coming up. They fast 30 days on Ramadan. We give tzedakah 10%. The only thing they get off cheaper is zakat. They only give 2.5%. We have Brit Milah. They have circumcision. We have Kashrut. They have Halal. We have Chesed. They have hospitality. We have Ole HaRegel, going to Jerusalem. They have the Hajj thing to Saudi Arabia. We have the Kedat Yitzchak. They have a holiday coming up in 2 days, Id al-Adha, the Feast of the Sacrifice, when Abraham takes Ishmael to sacrifice him. We have the temple. They have the gold dome. You know, we say, you know, I forgot this expression I wanted to use now, whatever. We have modesty. They have, you know, we dress women modestly. They put women in potato sacks with eye holes, like complete covered up. We have this idea, Kiddush Hashem, we give our life for God. They turn into suicide bombers. We blow ourselves up in buses and airplanes. Everything he's doing, with the exception of the tzedakah thing, is basically what? A more extreme version of everything we do. But why is he really doing that? Not because he's unbalanced and intrinsically cruel. It's Ishmael's descendants' way of showing what? I am, as we'd say in yeshiva language, frommer than you. I'm more religious than you are. I deserve it. I prove it in everything I do daily that I do what you do, only I do it better than you. Remember that, Andy, get your gun. Anything you can do, I can do better. It's exactly. Anything, any from this, any religious stuff you could do, I can do more religious than you. I'm saying it's unbalanced. It's a mirror image. It's lacking. I'm not saying it's the right thing at all. Don't get me wrong. But it's what he's trying to prove on a very deep, even subconscious level. Which means that the real rivalry between us and them is what? It's a spiritual thing over who's going to have the job. He takes it very seriously. You know, they say with blood and fire, redeem you El Aqsa, which is the dome up there. You know, like, we talk about nice things about Jerusalem. They talk about redeeming it with blood and fire. Everything is a more intense version. Which means that bottom line, he's the mirror image. A mirror image looks like, hold something in, in your right hand and look in a mirror. Which hand is holding it? The left hand. It looks the same, but it's really the opposite. It's a perversion of what we're supposed to be about. But what's the real message here, guys? So the real message is, of course, to end with, because we're out of time here. We began with Maimonides. Let's end with Maimonides. Here he is writing to the Jews of Yemen, who were under threat of like forced conversion and being persecuted by Muslims in 1172. And he's just like the beginning part is a perfect description of what's going on today with Ishmael. So too now, what he says to the Jews of Yemen like 900 years ago fits perfectly into the situation we're in today. Quote 30. Maimonides' epistle to the Jews of Yemen. And now, brothers, you must pay attention and listen carefully to what I'm going to lay out before you. Let not the strength of our enemy's hand and our own nation's weakness frighten you. For this entire situation is no more than a trial and a test so that you can demonstrate your belief and your chosenness to the world. And that's exactly the point. Bottom line, guys. Ultimately, it's a spiritual rivalry, and if we do our job and do Kiddush Hashem, and not just Israel's not supposed to be just a state of Jews, it's supposed to be a Jewish state that represents values and is a light to nations and teaches the world spirituality, and we complete the Jewish state, the Jewish people, the mission that Abraham started thousands of years ago, then even Ishmael will step aside. As a matter of fact, that's the last comment in the Bible. When Abraham dies, it says that Isaac and Ishmael buried Abraham, and even the word order is important there, Isaac being mentioned first. And we're told, by the way, that in the end of days, as we approach the final showdown, Ishmael actually comes back before Esau. He recognizes that he'll pay co-pilot to us in spirituality and follow our lead. But the real lesson is, all the defense budgets and everything aside, it's ultimately a metaphysical struggle. Sure, we got to defend ourselves and defend Israel, absolutely. But bottom line, unless we do what we're supposed to do as a nation and finish that job that Abraham started, we're never going to get the final peace that we're all hoping to get, and it should happen soon and in our days. And you should have a gemar chatima tova. Everyone should have a great year. We should have a peaceful year, and we should see Mashiach coming this year, hopefully by Sukkot in a few days, in which case, rather than having class next week, I will see you all up on the Temple Mount. We'll be doing up some holy sacrifices in the ultimate holy barbecue. Guys, Shana Tova.
So when Mashiach comes, there will be peace.
At the end of the process, it might be very violent until we get there, but ultimately, yes.
It will be very, very violent.
Ultimately, we get the